The raiders tried their previous tactic, shoving violently forward with the shield. This time, Alan met the attack with the full force of his weight upon his axe, splitting the shield and embedding it in the man who held it. He kicked the dying body, sending it back into the bandit who followed. Advancing, Alan used his axe to behead the marauder, who struggled to disengage himself from the corpse. Two arrows whisked by Alan's ear as George worked his bow, and another man fell. Alan shoved his way over the corpses in front of him, yelling wildly as he closed with the next man in line. The anger he had been holding inside burst its bonds, immersing him in a white-hot rage that left no room for thought. The great axe rose and fell, as arrows whistled across his shoulder. And before him, raiders died, only to be replaced by others. The rocks dripped red on both sides of the narrow chasm. Suddenly, the rush below them paused, as the men who waited outside became reluctant to enter the killing ground. A yell from above caused Alan to look back. On the high side of the chasm, Bill struggled mightily, but was being pushed back down the path toward them, Sam apparently having fallen earlier. George waved Alan back.
"Go help young Bill! I'll hold this end!"
Alan raced up the path, reaching Bill just as he staggered, a sword slashing his side. Alan grabbed his shoulder, tossing Bill behind him as he swung his axe with the other hand. The blow only partially connected with the sword that sought to block it, but its force was enough to break the blade. The bandit stabbed with the broken shard, but Alan smashed the blunt trailing edge of his axe into the man's face, caving it in and sending him flying limply backward. The upper part of the enemy force wavered under the onslaught as Alan worked his way up the path. He split the skull of the next man in line, impatiently tossing his body aside so that he could step forward to greet the next. His axe handle grew slick with blood. A sword sliced Alan's cheek open, but he paid no notice, his whirling axe severing the arm that held it, continuing in its great arc to remove the head from the body to which the limb had been attached. A low moan arose from those who stood before him. Trapped by those behind, they could not retreat before the blood-covered demon whose axe swept them from this world into the next. Alan's muscles bulged with exertion, and his breath now came in mighty gulps, but still he pushed forward. As he reached the upper entrance to the chasm, the last two men turned and ran toward their horses. Two arrows whispered over his shoulder, catching the first as he tried to mount, and sending the second tumbling from his horse. Alan glanced back to see Bill, weak with blood loss, lowering his bow and dropping to one knee, a knee that slowly gave way beneath him. Alan grabbed the ranger in one arm and carried him back down the chasm toward where he had left George. The old veteran sat at the lower entrance to the cavern among the corpses, a lone arrow jutting from his upper chest. He raised his head to look at Alan, who set Bill gently against the wall next to George. Seeing the question in Alan's eyes, George spat a red wad from his mouth and said,
"I nailed the last one to a tree down there, as he let loose this shaft. I was just a hair slow."
The ranger chuckled softly, a sound that took on a gurgle toward the end. He spat another wad of red phlegm against the wall.
"Ah, George,"
Alan said, a sudden wave of exhaustion and sadness assailing him.
"Don't you die on us now," said Bill, himself pale from blood loss.
"Too late, son,"
said George. Then he turned his head toward Alan, and a broad grin split his face.
"I'm just glad I got to see this day. Glad I got a chance to be a part of it. Alan, I swear to the gods I have never seen the like of what you did here. Your father would burst with pride. I wish I was going to be around to tell him, to see his face."
With one last effort, the veteran thrust out his arm, catching Alan's wrist in a strong grip.
"You get Bill on back safely. Okay?"
"I will, boss. You have my word on it."
The ranger smiled one last time and sank back against the wall, dead. Alan stood and screamed his frustration to the wind, a wild, lonely sound that echoed away into the canyons beyond. 8. Endless Valley. Your 414. Late Winter. Bill's gasp brought Alan back to reality. He stripped away the ranger's shirt and examined the wound, which was shallow but bleeding heavily. Alan bandaged it, holding pressure against the injury with his hand until the blood flow stopped. He would have to check the wound frequently during travel to ensure that the bleeding did not resume. Alan had endured similar wounds and had experience treating others that were far worse. Travel complicated the matter considerably. He picked up the semi-conscious ranger and carried him out of the narrow chasm, working his way along the hillside toward a place that provided adequate cover. A dense and thorny manzanita thicket worked. Having made Bill as comfortable as possible, Alan began looking for the horses. He found them, along with several of the mounts that the marauders had ridden, grazing on the scant grass at the bottom of the draw. The afternoon sun glinted off the water of a beaver pond. He worked quickly, gathering up his horse and five others. Retrieving water skins from several of the packs, he filled these in the stream and tied them to the saddles. He led the pack train back up to the entrance of the narrow chasm. By the time he had retrieved the bodies of his fellow rangers from among the piles of the dead, the light of day was waning. Alan tied the bodies of his friends across the saddles, his breathing coming in ragged gasps, unrelated to the effort involved. Then he swung his leg over his mount and headed back to where he had left Bill. He felt crusty, the blood that drenched him, some his, some from others, having long since begun to dry. The cut on his face, which began just above his left eyebrow and passed down his left cheek, still wept a congealing red ooze. The cheek had not quite opened all the way through, except in a half-inch tear in the center. Even that had closed with the clotting of the blood. Depression assailed him, making him long to lie down next to Bill and sleep, hoping that he would awake to find he had merely been having a very bad nightmare. That was not to be. Alan still had to backtrack and find the bodies of his other two comrades. Harry had been tied to a horse when they had been forced to release it, and Jim had fallen trying to slow their attackers during their mad dash to the chasm. Alan would not leave them to rot, their bones forgotten in the land of enemies. Bill roused as Alan examined his wounds in preparation for travel. He grimaced, but made no sound.
"Drink some water," said Alan, tipping the flask to Bill's lips.
The ranger drank thirstily and struggled to a sitting position.
"You look like the deep," he said, staring at Alan's face.
"Yeah, well, you've looked better yourself."
As Bill's gaze took in the horses with their dead comrades draped across their saddles, an expression as grim as Alan's mood settled over his youthful face, a face that looked as if it had aged several years in a day.
"Harry and Jim?" Bill asked. "As soon as we can get you mounted, we're going back to find them. We should be able to find Jim tonight, but Harry is tied to his horse. We'll have to track him in the morning."
"Let's get going then," said Bill, grimacing in pain as he got to his feet, his face pallid in the gathering twilight.
"I want you to tell me immediately if that wound opens up again," said Alan. "If you try to gut it out and keep it to yourself, you'll just hurt us both. If you notice it has opened, let me know. I'm going to need your help on this trip. If you pass out from unnecessary blood loss, that won't happen. I'll pay attention."
"Good."
Alan helped the injured ranger onto his horse, noting that he managed to sit well enough once mounted. The riders made their way slowly and carefully back to where Jim had died, keeping well away from the path they had taken on their initial ride, in case other marauders had discovered that trail. They found Jim's body just after midnight, full of so many arrows that it looked like a spiny monster in the pale glow of the quarter moon. Alan snapped off the shafts before lifting Jim's corpse onto a horse and tying it firmly in place. Alan then led Bill to a secluded spot where they dismounted to rest and wait for dawn. Sitting cross-legged, leaning back against the rough trunk of a juniper, Alan cast his glance toward the spot where Bill sat. In the fading darkness, the lad appeared to be a ghostly outline of himself, seeming to fade away as Alan tried to focus on him. A shudder of dread fluttered through Alan as he wondered momentarily if this was perhaps a portent of the young ranger's fate. The night was silent except for the faint rasp of Bill's breathing and the mutter of Alan's heartbeat. No gentle breeze stirred the boughs above his head or swept away the dampness of his condensed breath. The cold light of the gray dawn found the two rangers and their pack train of the dead working their way along the trail left by Harry's horse, Alan following it easily except for rocky stretches that forced him to dismount to avoid losing the path. A dreary drizzle wept down upon the men, matching their mood. Alan was thankful that the threatened rain was slow in coming, lest the trail be washed away, along with hopes of recovering Harry's corpse. The thought angered him. If Alan must return to camp after suffering such heavy losses, at least he would bring with him the shells of the men who had accompanied him. Rounding a bend, they spotted Harry. The saddle, to which George had tied the corpse, had slid awkwardly off to the left side, so that Harry seemed to lean against the big animal for support as it munched at a thick patch of grass. Alan dismounted and secured the lead rope of the horse. Moving around the side, he loosened the cinch and hefted the saddle and Harry's body back into place before securing it firmly once more. The smell that arose from the corpse clogged Alan's nose with a stench so thick that he could almost feel it on his skin, a thin mucous membrane engulfing him. That was the way of death, creeping in to rob you of the last simple dignity. Alan tied the horse to the back of their pack train before mounting and heading toward the distant mountains to the east. For 5 days, the two rangers worked their way back toward the great forest, where Derek's ranger camp lay in wait, sticking to the thickest brush and taking detours along rushing streams to throw off anyone who might cross their trail and decide to follow it. Despite Alan's best efforts at cleaning and bandaging Bill's wound, the lad continued to weaken, picking up a deep cough and a fever that worsened as days passed. Luckily, the wound did not become infected. The mountains rose before them now, seemingly close enough to reach out and touch through the crystal clearness of the high country air. Gleaming patches of snow lingered beneath the trees on the shady sides of the hills and in the shadows of the canyons. Pine had replaced juniper as the predominant species, their pungent needles indicating that home was near. The passage of the gruesome pack train startled herds of deer, sending them bounding along the slopes in graceful leaps. Alan now rode double behind Bill, supporting the delirious ranger in his saddle. He paused repeatedly to wet a bandana and wrap it around Bill's head to siphon away some of the heat of his fever. Still, Alan could feel the warmth radiating from the young man. The young lord heard the high whistle several seconds before its meaning registered through the deep haze of exhaustion that cloaked him. He pulled his horse to a halt, bringing the entire pack train up short. Three riders broke from the wood line a quarter league above him to the northeast, sweeping down the slope at a dead run. Rangers. The mixture of relief and sadness that assaulted Alan at the sight brought a witness to his eyes that he rubbed away with a dirty knuckle. He remembered what he had sworn to the gods he would never do. Once again, he was returning to his comrades, bringing only dead in his wake. He glanced at Bill. At least one was still alive and, with proper care, would recover. Alan leaned back in his saddle to await the arrival of the rangers, who raced headlong toward him. The looks of horror on their faces as they slid to a halt beside the pack train were quickly replaced with the stern demeanor that was the ranger norm. Through the red haze that shrouded his vision, he recognized Thade Spate, Frederick Cheels, and Keith Sampson. Good hands all. What had he seen in their faces along with disbelief as they had dismounted? It seemed to Alan that a judgment had been made, the outcome less than favorable. Thad reached him first and lifted Bill down, laying the ranger out carefully on the ground. He rapidly stripped the bandages from his wound and set about cleaning it. Alan dismounted slowly, the weariness weighting his body like the iron chains that bound dangerous prisoners. Keith reached out to help him, but Alan shrugged away, leaning against his horse for support as he staggered before righting himself to stand on his own.
"Let me examine that wound on your face,"
Keith said.
It has a bad look to it.
I'll be all right until we get back. Bill is the one who needs the attention.
Bill's getting attention. Now shut up, sit down, and let me check that cut. Are you hurt anywhere else?
Nothing serious, including this cut on my face, Alan insisted, although he followed orders and sat down heavily. As Keith poured water on a handkerchief and scrubbed roughly at Alan's face, breaking away the scabs from his sliced forehead and cheek, Alan could see Frederick moving down the line of pack horses, examining each dead ranger in turn. The grimace that pinched Frederick's face gained deeper purchase with each inspection, until the thin covering of skin cracked and tore. Deep fissures spread in a latticework across his head, peeling back the skin to expose the bone beneath. Fissures that now wept a thick gray pus, but no blood. To his horror, Alan saw that the gray matter that slithered from the cracks in Frederick's face was not pus at all. Alan lunged to his feet, knocking Keith backward as he rushed toward Frederick, then tripped and fell to his knee before righting himself once again.
What in the deep?
Keith said, as he lost his footing and sat down hard on the ground. Frederick whirled toward Alan, who reached out to grab him by the shoulders. Once again, reality shifted. The shock of seeing Frederick staring, his face normal in every way except for the probing look that gouged at Alan, brought him to a sliding halt. Alan swayed.
Your face, he began. But I saw it!
Keith's hand settled firmly on Alan's shoulder, turning him so that their eyes locked.
You saw what?
Alan turned to look at Frederick, once more noting the disapproving glare, but no sign of skin-splitting, brain-flowing madness.
Just for a moment, I thought I saw... Forget it. I guess I'm just too tired to make any sense.
Just sit down a minute, said Frederick, while we get Bill and the train ready to travel.
I haven't seen anyone following me, but it's possible.
The scouts are out, said Frederick. They'll work your back trail to make sure you didn't pick up any unwanted followers.
Now let's move out.
If he had not been without sleep for a week, if he was not weighted down with an overwhelming sense of loss and remorse, and if his sense of responsibility for the deaths of the Rangers had not been so great, Alan would have rendered a detailed report of the mission to the Rangers, even though he would have to repeat it to Derek Scott upon arrival at base camp. As it was, he waited, allowing the Rangers who now escorted him to form their own impressions. To them, results mattered. Even though Alan had not led the patrol on the way out, he oversaw what remained. George Dalton, dead. Harry Budka, dead. Jim Clemens, dead. Sam Jacobson, dead. Only Bill Harrison remained alive, and he clung to life tenuously. Alan had been out on two patrols on the expedition, and had one survivor, besides himself, to show for it. The results were in. He had been weighed, measured, and, in the minds of the Rangers, most glaringly found wanting. 9. Ariana's Vale, Your 415, Early Spring. High Lord Raphael paced among the ramparts of the lower fortress, accompanied by Battlemaster Gar. The preparations for the coming battle continued unabated, driven relentlessly by Hannibal. The young captain with the long red hair already seemed the perfect likeness to his father in his ability to effectively command men at any task, causing Gar to burst with obvious pride, although he never mentioned any of his son's accomplishments to Raphael directly. Yet the High Lord missed nothing, as evidenced by the rapid rate at which he had promoted Hannibal through the ranks. However, despite Hannibal's leadership and the extended efforts of the thousands of citizens who populated Ariana's Vale, they were clearly not ready to defend themselves against the hordes of brigands, wargs, and worse, that reports said now marched toward their mountains. Blade had bought them a winter of preparation. Now all they could do was pray that it would be enough. Raphael's thoughts shifted to his last sight of his daughter. Blade, mounted on his black horse, had carried her unconscious body out of the lower fort on their journey deeper into the high country.
She had looked so pale and vulnerable that Rafel had thought his heart would stop beating. But if anyone could save Carol from the trauma caused by her study of strange new magic, it was Blade, protected as he was by his enchanted knife, Slaken. Rafel straightened his shoulders. Worries about Carol were too terrible to be allowed purchase in his head, at least during the long hours of the day, when others looked to him to set a strong example. Carol's brother was a different matter. He worried about Alan because he could not avoid seeing him. Rafel was greatly pained to see how the soldiers shunned his only son. Alan had returned from the Long Ranger Patrol, scarred on the face and in his soul. He was a changed man, and his father was not sure he liked what he saw. Alan had always driven himself to work harder than any of his peers, but a wild joy and enthusiasm for life had supplemented that determination. Since the return of the ill-fated patrol, Alan's drive had become a singular obsession. He worked maniacally, barely sleeping, doing all his assigned tasks and dedicating himself to long hours of extra practice with weaponry, especially his axe. He had taken on a harder edge that made his training partners nervous. The reports from the fields were that Alan had fought exceptionally well, coming through nearly impossible odds to return from each of his two patrols. Bill Harrison, the lone survivor of the last patrol, had corroborated those reports. The young ranger was now so devoted to Alan that he seemed to be his shadow. Still, there was no denying that almost everyone who had fought beside Alan had died. That did not sit well with the soldiers. Then the rumors had started. People whispered that Alan's hero, Ty, was the earthly incarnation of the Dread Lord, a mighty warrior from Kalanthal, Realm of the Dead. These rumblings had started after Ty had battled more than a dozen Vorgs to save one of the horse warriors from the fortress city of Valdep. Ty, who had been bathing in a stream, had strode naked into battle, wielding his crescent-bladed axe. When the fight had ended, only the Qunjari's eyes had peered out through the blood that clothed him. The horse warrior legend had it that the Dread Lord, whom these people called the Dark Han, would one day return to this world cloaked only in blood to take mortal form. From among his followers, the Dark Han would select one, the Chosen, who would remain in this world after he departed. The Chosen would be the most terrible of all, attracting to himself the mightiest group of warriors to ever stride this world. And those who served beside the Chosen would die in glorious combat to rise once again in Kalanthal. Only when the Dark Han's appetite for new recruits was satisfied would the Chosen himself fall in battle and return to his master. Complete rubbish. What angered Rafel most was that almost the entire population of the Vale had apparently bought into the rumor. The legend had spread like wildfire among the soldiers, and most shied away from Alan. Nevertheless, a few of the hardiest fighters seemed attracted to him because of those tales. Rafel shook his head as if to clear it of these thoughts, and resumed his inspection of the defenses. The feeling of wrongness came over him gradually at first, but grew steadily. Gar had noticed it too, the grizzled warrior stopping in his tracks and looking around. A sudden hush fell over the fortress, where there had been a standard cacophony of spring sounds a moment ago. Suddenly not an animal or insect could be heard. Only the sound of the river rushing down the steep channel broke the silence. Even the soldiers fell silent as they too noticed the change. Above the north rim of the gorge, where skies had just been clear, thick black clouds now crawled over the rim. A group of soldiers in the courtyard saw them and stopped to stare, several pointing up at the unusual formation. It looked like an unnatural soup boiling over the edges of a witch's cauldron, thick tendrils reaching down along the canyon walls as the entire mass crept over and down. The air was suddenly thick with moisture. As the edge of the cloud crept down the cliff, strong bursts of electricity sent blue balls of energy scurrying among the rocks. Web-like lightning arced across to the opposite cliff wall, followed by tremendous volleys of thunder that shook the foundations of the fortress beneath them and threatened to break the eardrums of the stunned onlookers below. The ominous cloud crept down the wall until it was a mere 30 paces above the fortress. It paused, thickened, and bulged outward, moving directly across to touch the southern canyon wall. A downdraft of cold air turned the breath of the soldiers below into puffs of silver mist, visible in the unnatural darkness due to the lightning that crawled overhead. Above the fortress, 100 feet up, inky blackness boiled, spider-webbed with electrical arcs. Raphael's attention turned to a pair of riders rounding the bend in the canyon below. He immediately recognized Arn atop that ugly horse he favored, but it took him several seconds to identify Carol as the one who rode beside him. She wore trousers and boots with a white blouse. Carol's hair swirled around her head in the wind. The clarity with which he could see her in the near darkness was startling. A preternatural glow surrounded her. She was breathtaking in every regard, from the proud tilt of her chin to the confident and defiant look in her eyes, which seemed to flash with echoes of the lightning churning in the clouds above. His gaze shifted to Arn, clothed entirely in black, the man's demeanor an icy harbinger of death to any who might challenge them. As the pair came closer, the air grew so cold that all who awaited quivered. A wave of liquid fear accompanied the icy blast. Raphael felt the emotion and marveled at its magnificence, seeing that Gar's eyes also lit with recognition. How much time had passed since Raphael had experienced the thrill of genuine fear? He felt young again. The drawbridge crashed down of its own accord as the soldiers who manned the winch were tossed aside by unseen hands. Carol and Arn rode calmly across, passing along the streets of the fortress and out through the rear gate toward the forts that guarded the upper end of the ravine. As the two riders disappeared beyond the wall, the sky cleared as rapidly as it had clouded. Another sound provided accompaniment to the return of normalcy: the collective gasp of hundreds of startled soldiers. A snort escaped from Gar's lips.
"If that doesn't bear all the trademarks of a blade demonstration, I'm an old woman."
Raphael's smile matched Gar's own.
"Apparently, my daughter and future son-in-law have come up with a way for her to reintroduce herself to her people." "Well, it has style. I'll give it that," Gar said, turning to look at the broken winch. "It's a little hard on the fortifications, though."
Part 2. Why can I not see the ultimate outcome when all else is so luminous in my mind's eye? Is it because fate has not made up its mind? Or does destiny rest in the rune-covered haft of the blade that death wields? Everything will depend on the choices death shall be forced to make. From the Scroll of Landrill. 10. Ariana's Veil. Your 415. Early Spring. Back home within Ariana's Veil, Alan swung the woodman's axe in great arcs, each swing sending a chunk of timber flying from the 3-foot-thick trunk of the mighty spruce. The sinews rippled across his formerly thick torso, glistening under a thin sheen of sweat as he worked. The men on rest break near him whispered among themselves. They had been toiling in shifts for more than 8 hours, strong men all, and were exhausted. But not Alan, who had worked his axe since before sunrise, without even pausing for lunch. If anything, he seemed to grow stronger as the day progressed, driving himself with a monstrous will that allowed him no reprieve from his labors. Beside him, Bill struggled to match his efforts, although it appeared that the ranger might pass out at any moment. His breathing came in ragged gasps that rattled in his throat. Still, he did not quit. 2 days had passed since Arn had escorted Alan's sister back into the Vale, and Alan could not get that first sight of her out of his mind. He had been working, just like today, and she had ridden by him clothed in black and white, shimmering like a goddess. He had been so awestruck that he had failed to run down the hill to greet her. She had not seen him, and continued up the valley. When he had finally managed to find her, she had hugged him with more strength than he remembered. Despite her shock at seeing the scar down the left side of his face, the reunion felt wonderful. Far from the failing creature who had fled the valley, she was her old self again. That was not quite right. She had grown into something more. What? He did not know. As for Arn, Alan had never seen him so happy. Not that he gave any indication of his elation when in public. A rider galloped into the clearing behind Alan, pulling his mount to a halt just short of the resting men.
"Lord Alan!" he called.
Alan leaned the axe against the partially severed tree trunk and strode toward the rider.
"What is it, Bob?" "High Lord Raefel sent me to get you. He wants to see you in his council chambers. He said to make haste." "On my way," said Alan, grabbing his shirt from a branch and slipping it on. "If he doesn't mind the smell, then I don't."
The rider whirled his mount around and galloped back the way he came.
"You guys can finish cutting the tree," said Alan. "And if one of you could remember to pack that wood axe I brought up here and return it to the tool barn, I would appreciate it."
"I'll do it," said a panting Bill.
Alan clapped his hand on the ranger's shoulder.
"Thanks, Bill."
He walked to where his horse was tied, lifted the saddle to its back, and tightened the girth strap. Then Alan swung up into the saddle and galloped toward the main fort. Riding this narrow road always gave him a thrill. The view of the valley, surrounded by high cliffs, from which dozens of watery vales plunged thousands of feet to the floor below, was a mesmerizing sight. The domed peaks that towered above the rim were laden with snow so deep that the summer sun would be unable to melt it all away. Ahead of him, the main fort's eastern gate opened as he approached. The guards waved him through. Alan noted that the walls were fully manned, an unusual occurrence with so much war preparation yet to be done, so rare that it only occurred during full battle rehearsals. As he passed through the gates, another surprise confronted him. An entire company of the Khan's riders sat on their horses in formation, lined up against the western wall facing into the courtyard, over 100 riders strong. An odd trick of the late afternoon sunlight caught the reflections from the blades of their axes, which hung in straps from their saddles, sending multicolored glints spinning out into the eyes of onlookers. Alan leapt from the saddle, tossed his reins to a groom, and strode rapidly toward the council chambers. As he entered the large room, he recognized the Khan sitting beside his father, the two leaders deep in conversation. Also seated at the table were Gar, Hannibal, and another of the Khan's men, a striking warrior with long blonde hair and beard, whom Alan recognized. As Alan moved to the table, he thought he detected a sneer from Hannibal. That didn't surprise Alan. Their rivalry had its origin in Hannibal's belief that King Rodan should have given command of Tal's army to his father, instead of Raefel. To Hannibal, the reason was as clear as it was unfair. Gar held no noble title. Movement pulled Alan's attention away from Hannibal. Raefel stood, an action repeated by all at the table.
"Alan, you know Khan and his son Lerok."
Alan stepped forward and extended his hand.
"It is a pleasure."
Lerok gripped his arm in a warrior's welcome.
"Nay, the pleasure is mine."
Mandatory pleasantries out of the way, everyone seated themselves. Raefel looked at his son with a forced smile that left Alan cold.
"Several weeks ago, Khan and I reached an agreement with great implications for both of our peoples. I believe it makes defeating the army of the protectors possible."
"Yes," said Khan. "Although the deep-spawned army from the lowlands is on its way to destroy you and your people, once they have finished with you, they will turn their attention to your neighbors. The protectors have long sought an excuse to take that which is mine. Having raised such an army, they will come for my people next. If we allow them to engage us one at a time, they will roll us up, and we won't be able to stand against them. But together, we have a chance to destroy this foul tide."
"As I said, we have agreed upon the terms and warranties involved in this alliance," Raefel continued.
"And this is where I come in?" Alan said.
"I am sorry that I didn't consult with you," said Raefel. "But yes, Khan has proposed that he leave his son and a platoon of his men with us. In exchange, I have agreed to send you and a platoon of our soldiers to accompany him back to Valdep.
Alan nodded, a numbness creeping up his spine. So he was being banished, prevented from being present to help defend the Vale from the enemies that would soon crash against its defenses. From the slight smile on Hannibal's lips, the captain clearly liked this plan, a sentiment no doubt reflected among the vast majority of the soldiers, seeing as how they believed that fighting beside Alan was a direct ticket to the land of the dead. As he gazed into the captain's eyes, he had little doubt as to the source of that rumor. Despite the bitter taste in his mouth, Alan responded with a clear and steady voice.
How long do I have to make ready? Khan and his men will be my guests this evening. At dawn, you and a platoon of 30 soldiers will accompany Khan back to his fortress. Hannibal has already picked those who will go with you.
I would ask that you add Bill Harrison to the list, Alan said, rising to his feet.
Bill will go whether I like it or not, said Hannibal. I might as well let him think it was my idea.
Then if you will excuse me, I will prepare myself for travel.
Raphael hesitated, but then slowly extended his hand. Alan gripped forearms with his father as he studied the High Lord's face for any sign that he regretted the banishment that this act represented. Detecting no trace of emotion, Alan turned on his heel and strode from the room. A dismal mood settled upon Raphael's shoulders like a lead-lined cape, causing them to slump. The sight of Alan riding away from Ariana's Vale in the company of the Khan hurt him even more than giving the order that had made it happen. As he had known would happen, Alan had not understood. And why should he?
How would Raphael himself have felt if ordered to leave his people, to be unable to fight to defend them in a battle that might well be hopeless?
Alan would think that his banishment was because a great number of Raphael's soldiers feared to have him fighting beside them on the walls. The High Lord kicked the heavy wooden bench that rested next to the massive table in his council chambers, sending it tumbling across the room. There could be no doubt that he had made the right decision, a decision that cemented the alliance between the Vale and the people of Valdep, but that mattered little at the moment. A commotion outside brought his head around as the door slammed inward, propelled with such force that it burst from its upper hinge. The heavy steel-strapped barrier sagged like a drunken innkeeper trying to close for the night. In walked Carol, eyes ablaze, her dark hair swirling in a breeze that moved with her. Arn strode purposefully in her wake, although he stopped to stand near the door, looking back out into the courtyard. Captain Bannon, Raphael's personal guard, recovered in a flash and raced into the room, sword drawn. Arn moved as if in a blur, whirling under Bannon's sword, bringing Slaken up against the captain's throat and forcing him back against the wall.
Captain Bannon, said Arn, you know I've always liked you. Let's not do anything rash. Good to see you again, by the way.
What in the deep? Raphael yelled angrily, his gaze locking with Carol's.
I do believe those were my exact words when I heard that you had ordered Alan away without bothering to inform me, not even to give me the chance to say goodbye.
Her words carried an outrage that Raphael had never heard from his daughter. He was stunned, but immediately recovered his composure and turned to Bannon.
Captain, leave us, and ensure that I'm not disturbed.
Arn released the captain and resumed his place beside the entrance. Bannon nodded curtly and sheathed his sword, then left the room. Raphael sat down heavily.
For that, my daughter, I am deeply sorry. I negotiated the agreement with the Khan weeks before you returned, and I could see no good way to break the news to Alan or to you. You've been uninvolved in any of the decisions of this Vale for the last several months, even before you departed for the High Mountains.
It seemed to Raphael that Carol's eyes went dead for a moment before softening. Father, I am no longer the weak and broken girl that Arn carried out through your gates months ago.
Yes, but it might have helped if, after your grand entrance, You had taken the time to tell me of your desire to participate in the leadership of our people once again.
An invitation to your side might have hurried my steps in that direction.
Their gazes locked in mutually accusing stares.
You want to know what I think? Interjected Arn.
No! The word came simultaneously from Rafel and Carol. The self-conscious silence that followed was so comical that Carol reluctantly began to chuckle, a growing laugh that erupted in bursts between her reestablishment of a frown, sounding more like the croaking of a frog. The contagion spread to Rafel, who started harumphing and snorting until tears rolled down his cheeks. As they regained self-control, Carol threw her arms around her father's neck and whispered,
I missed you, father.
Rafel swept her up in a bear hug, pressing his cheek to hers, as his tears cut small streams that mingled with those from Carol's eyes.
I was afraid that I'd lost you.
Arn slipped out the door. For the longest time, Rafel held his daughter close, neither of them saying anything, immersed in the expression of feeling they had repressed for too long. When at last Carol spoke, words flowed from her in a torrent that swept away the remainder of the morning and most of the afternoon. She described Misty Hollow. She spoke of how Arn had helped her master the magic described in the Wielder's manuscript. Although she left out the details of what that magic involved, Rafel did not ask for more information. For his part, Rafel recounted their preparations for war, the scouting reports, and how the people had come to regard Alan as the chosen of the Dread Lord.
That's terrible, she said.
Yes, but you know how it is with rumors. You can't just put out an edict that no one's to believe them.
I can, she said, her eyes flashing.
Distant thunder rumbled above the fort. Rafel smiled and put his hand on her shoulder.
Somehow I don't think scaring them more will help. In time. It will pass.
If any of us has that much time.
Speaking of that, and having seen for myself that you have fully recovered, I will issue the word today that I have restored you to my second-in-command, followed once again by Gar.
Fair enough. Carol rose and kissed his cheek. It's time that I collect Arn and head home. We still have much work to do. As she left the room, Rafel called after her.
Please tell that fiancé of yours to lay off almost killing my guards. It's a little hard on morale.
11. Ariana's Vale. Your 415. Early Spring. Arn paused to look around at what he and Carol had accomplished in just 5 days of hard work. They had managed to construct a shelter similar to what they used as a home in Misty Hollow. The space was located up an isolated canyon that branched out of Ariana's Vale a league east of where Carol's cabin sat. They had required another 2 days to move all her things to their new home. The decision to move to a different location was an easy one, since it afforded much better security and privacy for Carol's mystical experimentation. The knowledge that the magic wielder was no longer directly in their midst also proved a great relief to the townspeople. The couple's new home was nestled beneath an overhanging section of cliff, looking out over a magical vista. This one, a narrow box canyon, where a waterfall that plunged 2,000 feet from the southern cliffs fed a rushing stream. And they had their own hot spring. Augmenting this luxury, the abundance of white aspen gave the canyon an otherworldly appearance. When he had suggested that they model their home after the makeshift lodging they had created in Misty Hollow, Arn had not known how welcome the idea would be to Carol. The separation from the common folk that populated the Vale was ideal for her study and practice, and considering how short a time remained before the coming battles, she devoted herself to those activities. A new worry crept into Arn's mind. Her powers had expanded so rapidly that he marveled at the things she could do with only an idle thought. Cook fires sprang to life as dinner time approached. Small winds scuttled through their belongings, blowing away dust and leaving items neatly arranged, as if of their own accord, while Carol was engaged in deep meditation on other tasks. Where control of such minor elementals before had involved concentration, they had now become her indentured servants, so fearful of angering the wielder that they strove to impress her with their devotion. It was as if she could see into their thoughts at a level that revealed their intent, and that no amount of obfuscation could mask. Elemental forces were not the only recipients of these new abilities. When Carol was moody, a quiet fell on their canyon, as if all living things had fled or cowered in their hiding places, fearing that the wrath of the gods themselves might smite them into the dirt. At such times, thunder rumbled above the canyon rim, and the wind moaned through the rock chimneys high above. Carol experimented with these feelings, drawing forth her own emotions and using them to pull power from unknown recesses deep within her mind. What alleviated some of Arn's concerns was the way she brought herself back to the smiling woman he loved whenever he approached. To say that her practice scared the deep out of anyone from the Greater Vale who happened to get curious and make their way into the Fairy Rift, as his and Carol's canyon had come to be known, was an understatement. Arn's threats to slowly cut pieces from their bodies until he grew tired of the sport did little to help the offenders with the task of recovering their equilibrium. For now, it suited his purpose that Carol and her surroundings be feared. The thin trail of smoke from a cooking fire drifted lazily from their hearth, carrying with it the smell of roasting wild turkey. Carol ran to meet him, as excited as a schoolgirl. She threw her arms around his neck, kissing him with a vigor that transformed his hunger. "Oh, Arn," she said, taking him by the hand. "I did it!"
"What did you do, love?"
"I finally figured out the voices that have been mumbling in my head. The ones that made me think I was going crazy before. The ones I learned to block in Misty Hollow. I know what they are." She paused, taking in a deep breath before continuing, the words bubbling out of her mouth in a rush. "Arn, I can hear people's thoughts, feel their emotions, see their visions. I'm still not good at it, but most importantly, I can block them out, thank heavens. There's so much that it would drive me crazy if I couldn't. It's like the babble in a large crowd, only worse. Images, sounds, feelings, tastes all flit across my senses from thousands of sources. I now see that the exercises from the ancient tome that deal with the pinpricks of light that surround me by the thousands are not only animals and elementals, but people, too. With people, it's much harder to filter them out, but I'm sure that with practice I'll be able to." Arn stared at her, a great foreboding creeping into his heart. He reached out and took her gently by the shoulders, turning her to face him.
"You haven't told anyone else about this, have you?"
"No," she said, her lips settling in a serious frown. "And I don't intend to."
"Listen to me. This new power of yours, you must keep it secret from everyone else. Not even your father or Alan can know of it. If anyone learns of it, the word will spread like a grass fire, and not only will everyone fear you, they will not tolerate you being near them."
"Believe me, I understand. I can imagine how people would feel if they think their deepest, darkest secrets are an open book to me. It wouldn't matter that this isn't how it works. They would believe I could look into their very souls. Instead, I think I only pick up the things they are consciously thinking, although even that's difficult, and I can't be sure that I'll ever get beyond that. I do seem to be able to influence the emotions of animals, and I would guess that I can also do so with people, at least somewhat. The possibilities are exciting, don't you think?"
"It scares the deep out of me."
Carol grabbed him by his shoulders and kissed him again. "You expect me to believe that, my love?"
"Well, it should scare me."
Suddenly, Carol raised her head to look down toward the entrance to the canyon. "Kim's coming," she said. "I can't see her yet, but she is close." Arn released Carol and stepped to the edge of the path that led up to their home. As if on cue, Kim stepped out of the woods and waved at them. Arn and Carol made their way down the trail to meet her, which did not take long due to the speed at which the Andarian woman covered the ground in her graceful jog. The two women embraced, and then Kim thrilled Arn with a big hug as well. "Oh," Carol said, "it's so good to see you. It feels like I was missing a piece of myself."
"I've missed you, too. Even the scruffy one."
Arn realized several days had passed since he had shaven.
"I was expecting you to call on me," Kim continued. But when that didn't happen, I decided to check on your well-being.
A reproachful frown settled upon her features. Carol's face flushed.
I'm sorry. I've wanted to visit you ever since I got back. But with the need to get moved so that the people in Longsford Watch could sleep soundly, I dallied.
You can blame me for that, said Arne.
Oh, and I do,
Kim said, although her mouth twitched with the hint of a smile.
No one could spend as much time as I spent with you, John, and Ty, without noticing that you don't always prioritize social graces.
Ouch, said Arne. I know you came to catch up with Carol, so I'll excuse myself. I need to go discuss a few matters with High Lord Raefel.
As neither of the women objected, Arne turned and walked out of their canyon toward the lower fortress. By the time Arne made his way through the gates at the inner mouth of the gorge and traversed the various switchbacks of the line of defenses to arrive at the lower fortress wall, the sun had risen high enough to send its rays glimmering off the rushing stream that roiled down the deep canyon's bottom. His stride quickened as he approached his objective. Something troubled him. The fortress was its normal hive of activity, as soldiers and workmen bent their backs at their various tasks. On the walls above, an alert watch manned their positions. The sounds of sergeants and officers barking orders echoed between the rock walls. High on the north wall of the canyon, two men toiled with a hammer and chisel along a narrow set of hand and footholds carved into the cliff face. They worked to improve the access route to ledges that the soldiers had weakened. On Raefel's command, they could send these shelves crashing down onto forces jammed up before the fortress walls. From where he stood, Arne could see one of the men gesturing to the other. The object of those gestures clung to the rock with both hands in a manner that Arne had seen many times before. He could practically feel the panic emanating from the man, frozen to the wall, several hundred feet above what was soon to become his grave. Arne reached the canyon wall at a dead run, kicking off a small ledge 2 feet up, propelling his body upward to a handhold that he used to launch himself upward again. He landed atop a narrow ledge that provided a short pathway upward to an inch-wide crack that wormed its way up the cliff face. Alternately jamming fingers and the toe of a buckskin boot into the crack, he sprinted up the vertical climb. He had lost sight of the men above, but the sounds that echoed down to him were not encouraging, the cascading rattle of small stones indicating that one or both must be slipping. Reaching the end of the convenient handholds provided by the crack, he was forced to slow his pace, each move on the rock now supported by only a couple of fingers or a toe. The thundering of his heart in his chest threatened to become loud enough to dislodge small boulders, but he redoubled his efforts to move faster. As he once again crested a narrow ledge, the two soldiers came into view less than 50 feet above him. The bigger of the two had worked his way toward the frozen one, and now extended himself outward with an outstretched hand, trying to grasp the other fellow's arm.
No! Jonesy! You stay away from me! You're going to make me fall! Stay away!
A sudden slippage of small stones accompanied the slimmer soldier's screams of panic and brought the efforts of the larger man to an awkward halt. Jonesy pitched forward so that his toehold failed, leaving him dangling from a single hand grip, feet scrabbling and searching for new purchase on the rock. Arne directed his climb toward the smaller man, who continued to scream. The fellow had the better spot to hold on to, but was rapidly losing his strength, having wasted so much effort clutching wildly in fear. As the gap closed, Jonesy slipped farther, and it became clear that he, too, was about to fall. Arne felt a wave of desire to save the braver of these two and let the panicked soldier fall. But perhaps he could save both. Arne reached out and grabbed the screamer, swinging his own body directly up against the young soldier's struggling form.
"Let me go! You're going to make me fall! Let go, I say!"
he yelled, kicking out at Arne and losing his grip in the process. The kick dislodged Arne's toehold so that he hung from a single hand, now supporting both his weight and the soldier's. Scissoring his legs, Arne gripped them around the soldier's body, just beneath the armpits, releasing his one-handed grip on the fellow and regaining a double handhold on the rock something that became more difficult to maintain as the lad struggled to clutch the rock wall.
"Be still!" Arn roared. "I have you!"
Arn looked over at the bigger man, whose position continued to deteriorate as he struggled to regain his previous spot on the ledge above.
"Hang on, Jonesy. I'll work my way over so you can use me as a foothold to push yourself up."
Arn pulled himself up, then switched grips with his right hand, regaining holds within reach of the large man. Jonesy grinned and swung his foot to use Arn's shoulder as a foothold, a move that never quite made it. As the man's boot neared Arn, the panicked lad he clung to with his legs reached out and grabbed it, attempting to pull himself up toward the ledge using Jonesy's body for support.
"Oh, no."
The words slipped from Jonesy's lips as his hands lost their grip on the ledge. For a brief moment, Arn's arms exploded in agony as the weight of both men attempted to wrench him from the stone wall. Then Jonesy tumbled out and away, bouncing off the wall 30 feet farther down to spin onward, a limp puppet that repeatedly collided with stone outcroppings on his way down. The canyon echoed with the sound of damp thuds. The soldier whom Arn clamped his legs around scrambled on the rock, threatening to dislodge them both from the wall. That movement suddenly ceased when Arn released one handhold to slam the hilt of his knife into the side of the soldier's head. Returning the weapon to its sheath and regaining his grip, Arn wondered briefly if he had killed the lad, considered dropping him, and then reluctantly began climbing, hand over hand, down the cliff. As he reached the ground, he loosed his grip on the soldier he had carried down the wall, freeing his legs once again, and letting the youth's limp form crumple to the canyon floor. Arn settled on his feet, almost falling as the full weight of his exhaustion bent his knees and left his arms hanging like a pair of sausages. He sagged backward against the rock wall he had just descended, working to bring his vision back from the narrow circle, surrounded by darkness, that seemed to want to snuff out the little center point of light. As his breathing slowed, Arn became aware of the hands that supported him at each shoulder, hands that belonged to Ty and John. They were saying something that he still could not quite make sense of.
"You crazy bastard," said Ty. "Why didn't you save the other guy instead of this little weasel who tried to kill you like he did the other fellow?"
Arn just shook his head, although the same thought had occurred to him numerous times on the way down. As he looked around, he saw that a small group had gathered around the unconscious lad, men who were in a nasty mood. Several had begun taking turns shoving the unconscious soldier with a boot, trying to rouse the fellow.
"Newton, wake up, you coward! You hear me?"
One of the men delivered a kick certain to leave a bruise. Arn freed himself from Ty and John's grips and stepped forward into the circle of men gathered around the lad.
"I'll cut the throat of the next man who does something like that. I didn't carry him down the cliff to have a mob kill him."
"Well, you should have dropped him," another fellow yelled. "He killed Jonesy as sure as we are all standing here. Killed him from pure cowardice, the way we saw it."
Arn's eyes blazed. "Did I say anything about wanting a conversation? Listen, I'm going to say this only once. Get back to your posts, or you'll join the dead fellow over there."
"What in the deep is going on here?"
The group parted at the arrival of Captain Hannibal, who quickly surveyed the scene and barked orders without waiting for a response to his question.
"Corporal Smith, I want these men put in formation and marched back to their posts immediately. Get two of them to carry Jonesy's body to the infirmary. Pick two others and have them take Newton there. I am going to have the ass of each one of this mangy crew who hasn't figured out what I mean by discipline and professionalism. Am I clear?"
"Yes, sir,"
said a man whose face was as red as Hannibal's flaming mane.
"Then move!"
Hannibal strode to where Arn stood beside Newton.
"I saw what you did up there. I've never seen the like."
He glanced down at Newton's unconscious body, now being lifted by two of the soldiers and carried away.
"Not being where you were, I'm not going to criticize the choice you made about who to save. I knew that kid was scared of heights, but I figured he would work through it. I sure didn't think he would panic."
"Some folks just can't get over it,"
said Arn. I'm sorry about Jonesy, though. Hannibal shook his head.
He was a very good man. Hate to lose that one.
With that, he turned and followed the soldiers back